I remember playing it the first time, and I was like, sounds a bit weird. I realised I was playing it all in a minor key, and it's me.
Yo, hello everyone. This is Chris from the Stage Dev Podcast. Welcome. This episode we've got Abby Harding from Abby Chan and the Zootons. And what a month it's been. We'll start with the end of the last episode with Gem from Oasis. It was his first interview in 5 years. And wow, the podcast totally blew up. It was the biggest episode in regards to listens and stuff like that. It got to number 2 in the iTunes charts, which was insane. Didn't quite get to number 1, but was kind of having a bit of a, like a pop chart battle with Graham Norton Show, and we were eventually above Graham Norton Show, and we were second to a podcast called Song Explorer. But it was it did really well, the podcast, and had literally hundreds and hundreds of amazing comments. So thank you for all of those. Like, it took so much time out of my day to kind of reply to as many of them as I could. So that was absolutely amazing. And a lot of people will know who listen to the podcast regularly. I have 2 other jobs away from this. This is something I do for love, to provide free educational content for young musicians going into the industry. And people can donate if they want to. And people did on the last episode. So this isn't everyone, but just a quick shout out to those who donated. So we had Derek in Nashville, Mark in London sent me some nice emails and stuff. And Yuka in Japan, who sent me an amazing email saying how much he was enjoying listening to from Japan. So do get in touch with us. You know, it's lovely to hear those messages. So thank you for your contributions. That will go towards equipment, to like these subscription fees that you have to pay so much for to host the podcast and stuff like that, and maybe to a bottle of wine while I'm editing the next podcast. So you can do that if you want to do that at the stageleftpodcast.com on the website. So going up to Liverpool for this episode with Abby was absolutely astounding. She paused the interview halfway through to make a cup of tea, and she gave me 2 vinyl records, which were the first 2 Zootons albums, and signed them. And you can see the photos of those and from the interview on the Stage Dev Podcast Instagram page. So go and have a look for those. But what a great interview. She talked really honestly about some kind of life-changing and life-shaping moments from her youth. Around, she had a really bad car accident and broke her back, and she talks about how she felt that was going to impact the rest of her life and how she got over that adversity. She talks about writing on really, really great songs as well that many of us all know, and playing on those songs. And she's talking about a lot about going from being kind of a stage left kind of side member of the Zootons, and now center stage. She's right in the middle. She's the front person of Abby Chan. But at such a good time that end up going back 2 nights ago for a night out in Liverpool, because I said I've never been to Liverpool. And her and Jim Sharrock and guys from, you had Boyan from the Zootons there as well. You had other members of Lightning Seeds and a few other people as well. It was a fucking banging night. It was absolutely brilliant. Sitting up till 5 o'clock, I remember at one point, this poor guy who had, I realised he'd written bass on one of my favourite songs ever called Science of Silence by Richard Ashcroft. And this guy called Martin, really top bloke, I made him watch this performance back of this song that I love so much, and he couldn't kind of remember it. And he showed a real active interest in the podcast, and he's going to come on, so he's going to be a future guest. And he's played with like Arthur Lee, he's played with the Lightning Seeds, and played a lot with Richard Ashcroft as well, in the studio too, and on records that ended up being sung over by like Brian Wilson and stuff like that. So he's going to come on the podcast, and showed a real active interest, so much so that he started formulating some questions that he wanted me to ask Wolfgang Fleur from Kraftwerk, who I'm meeting on Friday for an upcoming episode. So that was really cool. So he'll be on. Just quickly go back to the Gem episode. Just remember this. Gem sent me an amazing email afterwards saying that he'd had messages himself from friends saying how much they'd enjoyed the episode, and the kind of the love from all the fans, if you like, had really filtered through. And he said this great story that the night before they had played at in Buenos Aires at Argentina Stadium, and football stadium, and they played their set and U2 were due on, but Argentina had a really, really important away game that they had to win by a certain amount of goals to go through to the World Cup. And they went 1-0 down in the first couple of minutes. And they show this on the big screen between the two concerts, between Noel's set and between U2 set. And yeah, thankfully Messi turned it on. I think he got a hat-trick, and they got through, and the place was just absolutely like going crazy. And Gem was kind of relieved that they didn't lose, otherwise there might have been a riot. So again, really enjoyed the episode, and which is really nice, and he really enjoyed the feedback, which is cool. So the podcast also was featured in The Independent, which is now inews.co.uk, last week, which is really good. So it's a feature on Ricky Gervais's new podcast, and they did a little kind of piece on us. And just a quick few thank yous before we start to Andrew Velzian for his support continually, writing all the kind of spiel that we have underneath each episode that you see, and to John from Arm Your Ears, who is invaluable when it comes to kind of editing and stuff like that. So he's doing a great job on that. And to Andy Phelan for doing all the edits on the YouTube channel and running the YouTube channel. Upcoming episodes, John Woff from the 1975, who we had on before, went out with him a week ago or so, and he'd like to come on again, and he's got this idea that we should do one whilst like drunk, basically drunk versions of the Stage Dev podcast. And we were cool because we end up getting a bit off our faces and recording some of it, and some of it was really, really good, and we're going to try and use it. So he's listening back to it now and seeing what the bits we could use, so he may well be coming on again. We also are going to do a special with a band called Gold Heart Assembly, who are just splitting up now. They're playing their final ever concert, and so we're going to do kind of like a special episode where we kind of document with the two main guys from that band, their kind of career and that kind of thing. So that's what's coming up, and Wolfgang Fleur from Kraftwerk as mentioned. So again, thank you to Abby, thank you to Jim, thank you to everyone who's been behind this particular episode. It's a great episode. Thank you to Liverpool, and this is Abby Harding from the Zootons and Abby Chan. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians going into an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Today we're joined by Abby Harding, former saxophonist with the Zootons, and now the soulful voice and songwriter in Abby Chan, who in her time as professional musician has had incredible experiences playing the likes of Glastonbury and supporting the likes of Sir Paul McCartney, REM, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and even opened up to what was to be James Brown's final ever concert. Today we'll be discussing all those experiences and detailing Abby's venture from stage writing the Zootons to centre stage fronting her own band, Abby Chan, whose single Whispers is out now and is a bona fide fucking tune, so go out and check it. And we'll be discussing what it was like being central to Liverpool's music scene in the 2000s and what it was like playing Three Lines with the Lightning Seeds. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Abby Harding. Thanks for joining us today, Abby. How's it going?
Thanks for having me. I'm good. I'm very good. Thanks.
Good stuff. So it's been an interesting year so far. Your first gigs with the new band and the release of Whispers. Talk us through how it's been.
It's been really good. It's been like really, it's really exciting a lot of the time. But also slow in parts, I guess. Like the beginning of the year, we were getting ready to. We like just after I wrote Whispers and this other tune that we recorded that didn't come out, we spent time like getting it, me and my bass and drums player, spent the like, first 2 months getting like the sound we wanted with the electric drum kit as well as a real kit in the room, and then I knew I was going to do record Whispers, and that was definitely going to be one of them, and then this other one, and then went in March to do it. So that was all the beginning of the year just went so fast, and it was that exciting, and I wanted to get it out just more than anything. There was no like big plan, and like people kept saying, oh, you're gonna shoot yourself in the foot, you're just gonna whack something out, and what else have you got? And I'm like, well, I've got loads, but you know, I just want to do it to prove to myself that I can, and it's like something that I want to do, and I know I can do it, and I just loved it. I loved being in the studio more than ever. I loved doing that first gig. I was so nervous. Really? Like, oh my God, yeah. Like, I was just came out and was quite surprised about how many people were there.
What was the root cause of that nerves? Of those nerves?
Because I was fronting it. I had nothing to hide behind. I didn't have a saxophone. I had no, like, like, I didn't know what to do with my hands. Like, I didn't know where to look, like, because I could, you know people in the crowd. And just more than anything, like, forgetting stuff or anything that you know. Like, I used to do loads of, like, acting and dancing when I was younger. Mm. And whenever we'd do a play and I had, like, a spoken part, I used to have this dream for a week before, more, and I'd get to the wings and I I'd walk on and I wouldn't have learned any of my lines, and I just wouldn't have, and it was like that. I was having this dream where I'd get up and I didn't know any of my lyrics. Really? I was freaking out. I'd wake up sweating. And I love singing so much. It makes me feel so good. I just wanted to do the best I could and not make a fool of myself, I guess. And it was boss as soon, like, it went over so quick, and I just wanted to do it again as soon as I'd done it. So then I was like, right, got to get back in the studio. Let's get this other one down that we didn't quite finish or something the first, because we only had 2 days. We did the Whispers in one, and then we did this other one the next day.
That first gig that you mentioned, what did you do to get over those nerves? Or, you said you were worried about not standing behind your saxophones, you felt perhaps a bit exposed, you know, with your hands, that kind of thing, and worrying about the lyrics. Did you do anything to kind of mitigate those risks? Did you, like, I don't know, put the lyrics on stage, or did you just...
No, just practiced.
Just like, practiced?
Then, like, make sure I wasn't drinking or smoking, like, a week before.
And how did it go? What was the feedback like? Was it...
From the gig?
Yeah.
I was boss. Yeah, it was really good. I mean, there was quite a lot of friends and family there, like, and then I get, like, I've been asked to do quite a few more, but I don't want to just go out and do, like, a shitload of gigs and, like, because it's not like I'm a new band who's 21, you know, I'm a bit older, I've been in a band, I want to put out stuff, and then I'd love to get, like, beginning of next year, I'd love to get, like, a support tour, like, or, like, you know, Marchish sometimes, something like that.
Cool.
And just do a little tour like that, not just go out and do as many gigs as I can in Liverpool, because I don't think that's necessary.
And the material you were doing at those gigs, was it all new songs that you'd just written? Was it a set of all new stuff? Were you playing any covers?
We did one cover. It's a Doc Palmas tune. I just watched this Doc Palmas documentary, and it just, like, I've always loved, like, the Drifters and the Coasters and all that kind of stuff. It was like this little 2-2 minute tune that we put in at the end. So some of the tunes I'd had for, like, I think the oldest tune was probably like a year old or something like that.
Oh, right. So it's all pretty fresh stuff.
And then a few of them were like, well, Whispers was just written a few months before. This other one called Let's Stay Together. And the others were like a little bit older than that. But yeah, all pretty new stuff.
So you said to me before we started recording, you've been recording where we are at the moment and you're writing at the moment. What's influencing you from a creative aspect at the moment? Where are you getting your inspiration from?
Anyway, it's like, oh, it's always different. Like, I'm obviously, the music that you're listening to will go in you subconsciously as well. But, like, and music that you've loved for years, like Carole King's songs, like, a massive influence. The Beach Boys, they were probably a massive to me. But not that I don't really listen to the Beach Boys anymore. But I know when I got into them, that went in a lot. Like Neil Young, the Beatles, obviously, Sly and Family Stone. Like, that's my favourite band. They have a massive, massive influence on me.
You kind of got a blank sheet and you're kind of, you think, I haven't got anything to say right now. Do you know what I mean? Where do you go to then?
I'll just sit at the piano. I'll just write music, and then usually I'll just, do you know what? Some of my best lyrics have come from sitting at the piano and not thinking about it and almost just going, and sometimes you'll say something and you don't know why, but you're literally just making sounds. Or it's come from having a conversation with someone and you later on go, what was that thing I said? I didn't like that was dead true, and I wasn't thinking about it. Or something they've said to me.
Write down on your phone.
Yeah, like someone said something to me like, oh, your friends are just fair weather. And later I was like, I've got a bunch of fair weather friends. That's a good line. So it was just, I think a lot of my inspiration comes from like just going out, being with people, chatting to people, things that I hear going on, things that happen to me. Like,
how much do you think the environment affects subconsciously your writing? In the, so we're in Liverpool at the moment, but I know you recorded a Zootons album in LA. You can hear that.
So I think a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so that's not a myth. So it's like, I wonder how that record would have sounded if you'd recorded it in London or in Liverpool or somewhere else. Like, how does the environment actually affect you?
Well, I think because the guys who were working with us were American as well, even though we were in California and it was in LA and it was sunny and all that. But I think, you know, it was very produced and, like, it was a Bosch studio, but the songs were already written. So it wasn't like we wrote the songs in California. I'm trying to think of any word. No, they were all written back at home. So
all the producers.
Yeah, really, but the sound of it, kind of, the songs still sound like Scouse, because we're all Scousers and Dave's a Scouser, and they sound like Dave's songs. So, but I think it does a bit, the environment does have a bit of a, Dave always, like, he didn't really like the sun in LA, he didn't really like the heat that much, and he loves being in the cold, and he's like, oh, I remember him saying in LA, oh, I just want to get back to the grey, like, I love the grey, and I was like, what? I was like, I love it, I was the only one who, like, cried when we left, because I love the sun. But yeah, I think it does have a bit of a effect on the sound.
Being a saxophonist in the Zootons, and now obviously songwriter, lead, kind of been lead front person in this particular band that you started up, do you feel obliged to put a saxophone into records now because you're known as a saxophonist?
No, I try not to.
Right.
A bit. Like, but that's what I was thinking. I was like, I shouldn't. I was like, oh, it's like too gimmicky. Like, I imagined, like, standing at the front and singing and then just being like whipping the sax around and blasting a solo. Like, I'm not doing that.
So do you play that a lot? Do you play the sax live as well as sing?
No, I haven't yet.
But there are sax solos on some of them, right?
Yeah, the riff in Whispers is sax, yeah. But I think in sax a lot. So, like, if I ever come up with ideas, it's usually I hear it on the sax. Or, do you know what? I've started to hear it on, like, keyboardy synths, because I'm using a lot of that at the minute, but usually I'll put it on the sax and then go, oh, that'll be suited better for that. Because, like, when I first joined the Zootons, I used to listen to a few saxophone players, but, like, say for instance Charlie Parker, like that jazz bird guy, I put him on and I'd just be like, I don't know what he's doing, I don't understand it, like, I can appreciate it and I can think that's amazing, but I can't play it. Like, so I'd put on, like, The Doors and I'd learn Bobby Grieger solos, you know what I mean? That's because I could hear it was a melodic line. I could hear, if I can sing it, I can play it.
How are you finding being a band leader? Is it something that comes naturally?
I love loads of it. Like, I do. It's boss being able to hear your ideas and have, like, just ask people to do what you can hear in your head and then hearing it back. But when it doesn't work and you don't have another idea and you kind of hand it over and you don't like their idea, that's when it's, like, a bit, I suppose you're like, you know, well, maybe a little bit less like that, but you don't know how to, so you kind of just, I find that hard to, like,
deliver that feedback to
them. Yeah, because you don't want to be negative and you don't want to stunt someone, kind of thing. But you want your song to be good, so you kind of have to be a little bit.
So how do you do it?
No, I just say listen. I guess I'll just be like, when I go in, I'll try and have an idea of what I want and try and convey that to them. And if it doesn't work, then I'll probably just move on until I can think of another way that might work. Or if they do come up with something that's great, then boss, then it's a, you know, it's a working together thing, and that's great. But usually I'll just have to come away from it.
How do you feel about decision-making and stuff like that? Is that a bit of a weird thing, having to be kind of the person who's decision-making the band? Or are you very kind of democratic about it? Or
I think I'm learning quite a lot about that. I am quite democratic, but then usually go, shouldn't have been so difficult. All go, or I'll, let's be democratic, everyone say what you think. It depends, like sometimes I'll have a real clear idea and I'll know exactly what I want, and someone will say, but nah, why don't you just shorten that or lengthen that? And yeah. I'm like, nah, that's the way it is. I'll always ask them what they think, like, because yeah. I think it's nice to be inclusive of people, and it's nice when you feel like you're a unit. It's not just me going, do that.
Yeah.
Like, I'll go, oh, do this beat, do whatever you want into the court. You know what I mean? Like, I'll give them an idea, like, start, okay, I've got this baseline, and then take it where you want it kind of thing, but this is the idea.
In that area around decision making, have you learned anything from the Zootons time? Because when we had Russ on, he said that it's quite a stark difference having Noel Gallagher as like the kind of lead of his band, because the Zootons was more kind of everybody making decisions together, yeah. I think, and didn't have quite the same kind of, I'm not calling Noel a dictator, but you know, like, jumping that really kind of like strong decision maker, the boss. Yeah, yeah. He calls himself the chief, right? So, like, how does your setup at the moment in your band compare to the Zootons when it comes to that kind of stuff?
I'll bring the song in, like Dave would bring the song in, and we'll bash it around a bit. When I had like a guitarist and a keyboard playing with me as well, like when we were in the room practicing every day, I learned from the Zootons was like when we'd be writing, me and Boyan at the beginning, we usually wouldn't come in for the first few days. Sean and Russ would get the bass and drums with Dave, and then we'd come in.
Right,
and it's like, it makes it easier. Because if you've got five people going, what about this, what about that? But in my head, being the songwriter now, I find it overwhelming.
Yeah.
And if someone interjects when you're trying to think something creative and then you lose that thing, it pisses me off.
So
frustrating. I'll just go, can you just shut up a minute, like, and then but then you sound like a knob, you know what I mean? So you don't want to, so it's better for me like doing it with like the drums and the bass and then bringing other people in, and I can think clearer, and also just it's learning about yourself, like learning how you work. Like it's been a couple of years since I've been playing with other people for Abbey Chan, it's only been like since I suppose Whispers came up that I feel like the sound is really coming together and I know what I am more.
So it's a beautiful vocal that you've done on Whispers, and it's quite interesting because you sound quite a lot different, I think, from, because Dave McKay wrote a ballad called You Can Make the Four Walls Cry that you did a vocal on as well, and it's really good, like wicked vocal, but it's quite like, how have you developed your voice, and how have you gone about developing your voice in the last kind of say 10 years?
Dave would like me to sing quite loud all the time, and he'd want me to, because he sings quite loud, he's got a voice it's an amazing voice and he can really belt it out, and he used to like hearing me do that. So say for on Four Walls Cry and on Why Won't You Give Me Your Love, it's at to sing,
it's
from my
high,
belly, it's high,
it's
so
really
I have
high.
To push it,
yeah, you do.
But since doing Abbey Chan, I suppose in the last two to three years I've just really learned how to sing better. So singing, I used to always sing on stage, we never would use mics, you know, like doing when I used to dancing and singing and stuff, so you'd have to belt everything out, but using a mic is completely different, and you don't, it's all about control, and I've learned what I like in my voice.
The recordings you're doing, are you working with a producer or are you self-producing?
Tim recorded that for me. The Whispers was done by Tim, my bass player. So we all just kind of did it together, and he mixed it all after and that, but we were like, I like this and I like that, but we don't, you know, we're all like, I'm super new to like, I don't know how to speak in like in a studio sense, but I know what I like,
I know
what I don't like, so I'll be like, I'll be like, how can I describe, it's like, you know, I don't even want to sing, it sounds like corny. But, you know, I'll usually talk about nature, like, you know, when you hear the wind sound like this, but it's not too heavy, but it's a bit more like this. Can you make the bass just like whisper a bit more like that? Or, you know, just like something stupid. Or
that's quite a challenge, I guess, for Tim to then have to
translate that.
Yeah, pressing buttons.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I try to find it. And
but we like loads of the same music as well, so I think. If you can reference a song, that's much easier. If like, oh, I love that bass sound on that Funkadelic tune, it'll like go, okay, you know, and that's, because you can go and listen to that.
Those
you can't, yeah, 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 you can't get in your head and go, which kind of wind is she talking about?
so the new band, Abby Chan, you've got Jim Sharrock, who's Chris Sharrock's nephew, and Tim Cunningham on bass, as you just mentioned. What do they bring to the party?
Oh, loads. Like, when you've said about, you know, decisions before, and it's like having two people around who you trust as well to to be that honest with you. And they're brilliant. Like, they're both great musicians. They can both play pretty much anything you ask them to play. When I'm, like, not quite sure on, like, you know, anything in the tunes, like, even if it's a lyric sometimes, or you'll be like, oh, you know, what do you think about that? And they won't just go, oh, it sounds, you know, they'll say, oh, you know, that doesn't need to be there, just jib half of that chord, you know what I mean? They're honest. They're both dead open-minded. They're both, like, willing to try anything. And even at first, if they're like, do you sure you want that? They'll still, you know, like, you know, give you a go kind of thing. And
the name itself, when I interviewed Russ, we spoke afterwards and we were talking about your new record, and he said, so is it right that the name Abby Chan came from, were you touring Japan?
Yeah.
And it's the kind of, like, Daniel San for, like,
Yeah, exactly.
Is that what it's from?
That's exactly it, yeah. So it's just like, all right, mate. In Japan, they say, you be Chrissy Tan. Abby Chan.
Got it.
It just means, like, sweet Abby or cute Abby or something. Or it's just like an endearing term.
Endearing term. Cool.
But, this is what I thought, and then when I was like, definitely this is the name, I was like, I better check this out. And a couple of websites said different things, so I'm just going, that's what they definitely, it was Abby Chan, that's what they used to call me. But on this one of this websites, it said, you only use it to a kid. But I was like in my 20s when we were there, so
yeah.
I'm going with what I think, my original thing was.
So we have listeners all over the place in lots of different countries, and I wondered if you could paint a picture of growing up in Liverpool for us, because there's a lot of people who won't know too much about Liverpool other than the Beatles are from here, and actually today's my first time in Liverpool.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could paint a picture of growing up in Liverpool, what that was like for you?
Well, I was born in Bristol.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, I moved here when I was a little kid. So, Liverpool's my home. I call myself a Scouser. I've obviously got a Scouse accent.
How old were you when you moved?
I was, like, 6 when I moved.
Okay,
so, I went into infant school when I went in. And, you know, I didn't speak like all the little kids. So, you quickly learn to speak like the other kids. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then it sticks. But, like, I've got 3 sisters. My older 2 sisters they haven't really got Scouse accents. But me and my little sister have, because we were a lot younger. I loved it. Like, I loved growing up here. I don't know. I was just like, I just get stuck into anything, really. Like, in school, I was always just got into sports, got into, like, the drama, the music, the dance and all that.
When you were growing up, you had quite a serious accent as well. Is that right?
I don't know.
Research. Yeah. How old were you then?
I turned 15 when I was in hospital.
You broke your back, is that right?
Yeah, broke my back in a car crash, yeah. It was full on. Do you know what, that was one of my best mates, mum, was asking me about it the other day, and she's quite sick, and she was saying, she was like, you know, how did it affect you and all that? And I was like, do you know what? I just didn't let it. Like, you know, it could have, looking back, I could have, like, really let it, but I just didn't believe, like, when it actually happened, I just didn't believe it. I was like, I remember getting told that I broke my back, and, like, lying on this plastic board and just being like, oh, shut up. Like, you couldn't really feel it, but, you know, then you're on all kinds of drugs, so you don't feel it. And I had really great doctors, and they were like, you know, your back's stronger now than it was before. I've still got loads of metal in it.
Really?
Yeah, but then my dad said to me, like, right, there's going to be this thing turning up to the house, this letter, it's going to be addressed to you, but you're not to read it. So it was like, well, the first thing I'm going to do is going to be looking for the letter.
Yeah,
if it's addressed to me. So this letter come, and I found it, and I was like, Sam, this is the letter. And it was all to do to get, you know, to claim compensation. So you had to have, like, a best case scenario and a worst case scenario. So the best case scenario was like, oh, she'll be fine. She'll just have to wear this body brace for 6 months. Then she'll be fine. She can do whatever she did before. Get her rods taken out when she's 35 if she wants. Doesn't have to. She's fine, basically. And then this worst case scenario turns up, and it's like, she won't be able to walk after, like, the age of 32. She'll be in a wheelchair from 35. She'll never dance again. I used to do gymnastics and all that. She'll never, like, do a cartwheel, whatever, you know. It was like, she's fucked, basically. And I remember reading it, just going like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, no way, I couldn't believe it. Put it back in my dad, but I was crying, and my dad found me, and I was like, I read the letter, and he was like, I told you not to read. I was like, I know, but what the, you know what I mean? And he went, well, it's just, it's to get your more money, basically. Yeah. He was like, you know, it's for the compensation thing.
Did you have fears then about like not being able to do, because you talked about dancing and singing and stuff like that.
I never believed it. Believed that it would affect me. Like, I was just like, nah, I just chose not to. And it hasn't. Like, it hurts, it aches a lot sometimes, but it's fine.
And the saxophone, why the sax? It was the flute first, right?
Yeah, it was the flute first. Well, so the flute's the same finger and a saxophone. So,
oh, is it? Oh.
Yeah, so in like junior school, I played the flute. And but I remember just being like, that's well better, because I played in the orchestra like a little bit, like I'd never really liked it, but it was just like that's where I got to play, and you know, there wasn't like, I don't know anyone who was in a band in junior school and nothing like that, and then, but there was like saxophones over there, and I was like, that's well better, that's well cool, and I think I just wanted to make more noise, because the flute's just like, it's so ladylike, and so no, I just wanted to be a bit more raucous, and then my grandma got me one, like for Christmas, it was like quite out the blue, and
Had you asked? Had you kind of?
I mean, I'd been telling my dad and my mum. I was like, I'd love to play the sax. Like, I much prefer to play the sax and the flute. Didn't think anything of it because they were like, "Nah, you've got a flute. Your flute's for you. You're playing the flute. We bought you flutes. Don't think you're getting a sax." And then my grandma bought me a sax for Christmas. I was like, I was like, you usually get £25 off your grandma, but I got a sax. I was like, what the fuck? So yeah, and then I started playing, but that was just before. No, that was just after, just before I broke my back, but I couldn't hold nothing. It was because I remember not being able to play it afterwards.
Yeah, of course.
Because I couldn't.
Because heavy as well.
Yeah. So yeah, I just, I think.
And did your grandma ever see you play sax at any gigs or anything like that?
No, me other nana did, but no, grandma, she never got to see that, no. She heard me play when I was learning, and I think everyone didn't like that. Everyone put the fingers in their ears.
And were you reading music? So did you have to teach yourself music?
You know what? You need to practice it to keep it up. Like, I could, if you put a sheet of music, I'd go A, C, B, and I'd work it out, but I'd play it really slow. It wasn't until I joined the Zootons where that's when I proper learned.
So when you were learning it, did you get a teacher to teach you?
Just by my mum's. There was this fella around the corner, he'd just say, what do you want to play? And I'll go Beatles. So he'd go, yeah, it's a Beatles tune, but you just learn the melody,
so the vocal melody,
you'd just be like learning to read music. It wasn't until like he said to me, you just need to join a band, you know, I had a few years, and he was like, if you want to get any better, or you want to learn to like improvise, you know, I can show you. And, like, we can make a little tape and you can be, like, a solo in the middle. But the first time he did that, I remember just being like, what?
Yeah.
What do you mean? And I was like, well, what am I meant to play? And he was like, just make it up. And I was like, okay. And I remember getting dead nervous and being like, it's coming. Well, now I'd be like, oh, God, how do you read that again? No, I'm much more.
So you're much more feel now. And
And that's how, like, you were saying, ask me about the tenor before. Could you?
Yeah.
So I've always played the alto, so I know what I'm playing on the alto, but I could work it out what I'm playing, but I couldn't be like, oh, this is a B, this is an A, but I can on the alto. I can go, I know that it's 7 semitones away, so I'll go, okay, this is an A, but I've never properly gone, like, it's never gone in properly on the tenor, so I'll do it all by ear, so I'll just go, okay, you know what I mean? And I don't really know, theoretical.
Okay, so the Zootons was a great time in your career, I'd imagine. I imagine that was incredible. What are your fondest memories when it really started to kick off? So the first, that first album is absolutely killer. So many great tunes on there. What are your kind of fondest memories recording that and then touring that first record?
Recording it, I was really young and, you know, I'd only been in the studio once before with the Zootons, like, for a day or something, and it was all, like, you know, really new to me. But it was great. It was like we were living in the studio, and like it was all like the food catering and all that. Ian Brody was the producer,
right?
So
okay.
We already knew him. Like the lads knew him probably better than I did. But he's such a nice guy to work with, and makes you feel so comfortable. And because I was so not, I'd never been in this situation yep. before. All the lads have been in other bands before the Zootons, which I'd never been in a band before. So. It was quite nerve-wracking, and they were all, you know, they were just a lot more experienced than I was. I was a lot younger, or I was a little bit younger. So I have really fond memories of that time, like living in Rack Studios, just getting to know Ian more. Even like, I remember doing all my parts, and Ian's such a nice guy, and like, he's really great to work with. He always made me feel, he always took the nerves away more than less, and he never like, at the time, you know, I definitely got a lot better on the sax throughout the Zootons, and it was still, you know, it was quite...
Learning your craft at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, to be bang on in tune was still probably something that I was learning kind of thing. Yeah. And, you know, we didn't use any flipping auto-tune or anything like that. Mm. So it's a little bit out on some places, but he never...
Is it?
Yeah, he it. Never... Yeah. Radio 2 wouldn't play Confusion because they said the sax was too edgy, out of tune.
Fuck off, really?
Yeah, yeah. So it was like, take the sax off or we won't play it. And the huge man will don't play it then.
I was really? Like,
because the sax kind of goes all the way through it from the first chorus, it's in till the
yeah.
end. So I think we said don't play it.
How did that hit your confidence when you heard that? Like,
I just used to take it, just brush yeah. it off. Yeah, no, you can't let things. People are going to say, like, I remember reading like a bad review of us once, or like the first time I'd read one. And the record company, but we were in Maida Vale Studios, and they brought in this stack of all the interviews that, like, in written up. And I was like, my God! So I was like, amazing, amazing, amazing. And then it was like this horrific interview, and I was like, oh, and I was so offended.
Uh-huh.
And then I just went, don't read it. Like, why? Why? You, not everyone's gonna like it, and you can't. And from that, I think from that moment, I was just like, it's part of it, isn't it? You know what I mean? I don't like.
I think that's normal. If you've got 90, you've got 100 interview or reviews, that, you know, yeah. 100 and 99 of them are great, you're only ever going to focus on the one that's
yeah,
bad.
Of course,
like, what the
yeah,
fuck is that about?
Course, you know, yeah. yeah.
That's natural.
But what did you ask me to say, please?
Well, actually, I was going to ask you about, we could just go back in your answer there, you said about Ian Brody,
oh,
got
yeah,
rid of your nerves. Like, how did he do that? Like,
he just put, I don't know, he's just, like I was saying to you before about with the lightning seeds, and when he wants something doing differently, he makes you feel, you don't feel like you've done something wrong. He makes you, he always says a positive thing first. In the same way as that, in the studio, he's just dead gentle and like he taps into the way, I think he's dead intuitive and he knows how you're feeling. I think he could probably maybe tell I was nervous or...
Yeah.
Or he's just like that. He's just a really nice guy and...
It's quite an understated character, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and he just make you feel super comfortable and,
yeah.
you know... So I'll be doing a take or whatever, and he'd just, like, you know, press the button and be like, oh, you know, that was great, but let's, you know, just go again, just do a few more takes, we'll have a tune, and just always, I don't know, he's just, his vibe.
Reassuring.
Yeah, and he's just really easy to work with and really nice.
Apart from that, what do you think he brought to the Zootons? So how would that record have sounded differently if Ian Brody hadn't, have produced it, and maybe you self-produced it?
I have no idea. I know that he went into the songs more than I think other producers do. So I think you get people who, because the word producer I think is quite, it's different to all producers. So some people would just press the button and record. Yeah, some people will like take apart your song and go, okay, this needs work and whatever. And I think he was more in depth like that, and I think it brought the best out. So I know on a couple of songs, I remember him sitting off with Dave and being like, okay, let's just play these on the acoustics and let's just go through this song, and they fine tune them. So he's a musician, so that's it. I think if, you know, being a musician, he just looked into everything to make the recording of the song and the song the best it could be, and it really worked. He got us, you know, we'd sing all the backing vocals around one mic. For some of them we did it all together, and it was more like he'd get the vibe right, and get that across on the record kind of thing. And like you're saying, but putting everyone at ease. And I remember when we first would record whatever song, we'd all be in the same room, we'd all do it live. Sean would be behind the glass, which I know was frustrating for him. Where I'm always put in a booth, you know what I mean? Yeah, you're like, my headphones aren't working. What are you saying? I can't see you. But so I know it can be frustrating that sometimes, but if you're all playing live, even if you don't keep everything, which you usually wouldn't, you get the atmosphere, you get the vibe, you get that live feeling. And then you come away, you usually keep the bass and the drums or bits of them or whatever, maybe do a couple of overdubs, and then overdub the guitars or do the sax again, the vocals. And that way you get the first thing that you've done is this boss vibe, because everyone's playing it together. Good. And you're doing it off each other. So he did that, and we'd always do that.
You always seem like a gang, you guys. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a good like kind of gang mentality, or you just seem like a real kind of band, a bit kind of a good group. And I suppose he's captured that in the studio as well, which is sometimes quite difficult to do.
Yeah, right? No, I think that's an art in itself. That's a really good producer doing that. I think to see what is good in a band and capture that on record, it's just being that sensitive to everything, isn't it? And to the best things about it, the things that you want to hear and the things that you think other people will, and then getting that, capturing it.
Yeah.
And I think he did do that.
So you then went and toured it, and how it obviously did really well, the first album. Mm-hmm. And how did you deal with kind of all of you then kind of being in the spotlight and that kind of stuff? That must be such a surreal thing. You were nominated, I think, Best Breakthrough Artist at the Brits and stuff like that. So you must have been starting to hang around with people who you probably looked up to at times. How did you deal with kind of all that kind of stuff? Was that weird, surreal?
Yeah, I always found weird doing interviews, like, just because you don't know how to, like, you know, you're just not used to talking about yourself so much, maybe.
Yeah.
But when you're doing it, like, when you're touring, you're just doing it.
Yeah.
So you don't, like, and it was constant for, like, quite a few years.
Yeah.
I remember one year, I think we were at home a week sporadically, like, a day here, and then a few months later, 2 days. Like, I never saw anyone, you know, you were away a lot. But you're just living it, and you're just doing it. And you don't really think about that, and the only time I think about, like, meeting people or, like, being rubbing shoulders with people that, you know, you look up to was, like, festivals, stuff like that. And you'd be like, oh, my God. And that was just that exciting. But I don't know. I think if you dwell on shit like that too much, you probably get a big head and think you're one of, you know, these big guys now. But I don't know. I'm dead appreciative of it. And I think I've been so lucky and all that. But I never thought about it like that when I was doing it.
If you look back at Amy Winehouse and Pete Doherty, people like that, a lot of kind of people now think that kind of rock and roll excess behaviour is actually people kind of almost self-medicating for the fucked up world they found themselves in.
Yeah,
fame and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but we never had that. Like, she was that when you see footage of Amy Winehouse, like, I'm still so upset about that. Like, I fucking loved Amy Winehouse. She was, like, one of the people I would, like, I wanted her to like our music. And when she did Valerie, it was, like, such a fucking big compliment. Like, you know, it was a massive thing for me. I just, because I loved her so much. But you can totally see why that... Well, you can understand it. Maybe not see, but you can understand it. They just didn't get a minute. They don't get a second. As soon as she leaves the house, there's hundreds of paparazzi trying to get that. Must have been horrible. Like, that must... We never had it. It was never like that for us. Like, we had success and stuff, but not to that extent. Like, that was, she's just hounded. Like, just people trying to trip her up all the way. How would you know who to trust? People trying to have you off all the time. It's so sad, like, what happened to her. And we were never that level, you know.
With the success of the first album, you then went into the studio to record the second album. The second album is just as killer, absolutely, like, full of great tunes. Do you think there was a pressure that you didn't realise when kind of, like, subconsciously writing, from a creative point of view, if you've kind of already sold X amount of records and that kind of thing, was there a pressure you felt going into the second record to be like, let's not fuck this up, or anything like that? How did you approach that? Did you feel...
Yeah, I think so. I think I see it now, being, like, writing songs myself. You give yourself... there's always pressure, like... There just always is, because you just want it to be the best and you want other people to like it, really, don't you? And obviously you want to like it, but there's always pressure. But I think looking back, you do want to, you just want to make something as good as the last one.
And how do you? So you did that, I think, in with the second record, and obviously like Valerie was on there and stuff like that. So like, how do you not kind of let that in too much? Like, can you? Did you think? Did you ever think about it? Or was it a case of not overthinking about it?
Yeah, you can't overthink it. Yeah. I think that's it. I think for me, being part of it as well, not being the one person. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got. It's great to have other people around you who are in on it with you. You know, and you're not just on your own going, is this any good? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. There's five of you going, this is fucking boss, and we know it. Like,
yeah.
I never doubted how boss we were. Like, I knew we were boss. Like, I always thought we were the best. Not to be big-headed, but I did. I did, I thought we were brilliant.
So let's talk about some of the kind of career highlights, particular gigs. I mean, some of the people you supported, what did you learn observing some of these people? So, like, you played before Chili Peppers, I think, and... obviously the Capital Culture gig with McCartney, he played that. Talk about some of your career highlights from people you've played with or supported, and maybe what you learned from them or observed.
James Brown, that was like, watching him sound check was like better than the gig almost. Like, he's just everything about him, like his style, the way he moved, the way he walked, the way he spoke, just everything was just like, you just couldn't stop watching. Like, I remember being outside having a ciggy or something, and this car comes in, it was the back of the roundhouse, and it was like, oh my god, he's here, oh my god, it's James Brown, James Brown. And he gets out the car with like his security, and like, you know, he's always got like two guards kind of with him, and he had on this like chocolate brown suit, like cut so perfect for him, and then when he walked past it, like the back of it had like pleats in it, it was stunning. And then the way he ran the sound check, like, he's James Brown, you know, he's obviously the boss, but he had Max Beasley playing piano for him. But the way he was just... It wasn't as harsh, I think. Maybe because he was a bit older. He wasn't as harsh as I thought he was going to be. But he was just a master. Like,
in what way? So what would a musician observing that learn specifically?
He just knew everything that was going on. He knew, like...
To get the right sound that he wanted on stage?
To get exactly what he wanted, the right feel, the right sound, whatever it was. He'd stop when... I remember watching that This Is It, Michael Jackson... And he had that as well. I was like, this is like the way James Brown was. And he'd hear something that you wouldn't have heard. And he'd be like, stop. Okay. But then Michael Jackson would be like, okay, can you just run that one more time?
And he'd be like, I mean this with L-O-V-E, with love. That's what I mean. So you didn't want to hurt anyone's feelings. But was James Brown like that? Or was he like,
no,
stop?
No, but he wasn't so harsh. I don't remember him as harsh, but he was just in control. I don't know, like... I don't know if I learned anything off him, but I just remember being in awe of him, like, completely. But then being gutted that I didn't get to meet him, like, walking past him, being like, hi. You had to call him Mr. Brown, you weren't allowed to call him James Brown.
Who told you that?
His manager. So this manager guy, I forget his name, this big guy, he was like, you only call him Mr. Brown, he's not James Brown or James, he's Mr. Brown. So... And then he was guarding the door. His dressing room was right next door to ours. I know you've heard this story, but
that's brilliant.
Mine's crap because Russ's and Sean's is so much better. And Sean and Russ had bought records for him to sign if we were going to meet him. We waited outside the door for like 20 minutes. And this manager was like, guys, you ain't getting in. You ain't getting in. And they were like, just wait here. And I was like, so 20 minutes after, I was like, guys, I'm getting off. Like, I'm just going to go get a butty or whatever. Got off. And then apparently 2 minutes later, the manager got off. So Sean and Russ just walked in, and they, you know, what happened there. So I just missed out on that. Alan Toussaint, he was I went to see him.
Did you?
Yeah, in the Philharmonic Hall, and he was like, he was amazing. Like, he did it in 2 hours. He came on first, and he just played the piano for like an hour. Oh. And he'd be playing, like, he's got this tune called Southern Nights. I don't know if you know it. And it's all about his grandma and the way they'd sit on the porch. And when he was talking through this, he's playing the riff in the song, and it's like this dead pretty piano line. And he's telling you about his grandma sitting on the porch. And then he goes into the song, and the way he can tell a story about the song he's about to sing, which is the story kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then he goes into it.
Nice.
I'm just in floods, like crying. Oh. And he's like the most gentle man, like, just, I don't know, like, there's no arrogance, there's no, like, you know, Mick Jagger a bad, like, that's great in another way, but like, he was just the most softest, kindest man, gentleman, and the way you just saw that, the way he played his music, the way he spoke down the mic. And the second half, he had the Preservation Royal Society come on, and it was all right, but you just wanted to see him. But he come on in like this linen suit with like socks and sandals, and he's just comfy, and he just walks in slow, you know, there's no rush. I suppose he's like quite like what this story is telling everyone. It was like a slowed down version of life, and the way he used to sit on the porch with his grandma, and the night used to come on, kind of thing, and whatever you say, you know, it would go dark or whatever. So I don't know, like, learning to be yourself, I guess, is the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Like, you see on other people, and when you see, it's not fake. Like, you see, and obviously you can take on like a confidence or whatever, because you can't go on like little timbers or anything like that. But being confident, but being yourself, and not worrying about trying to be something, just trying not to be something you're not. And the only way you're gonna, I think, do your best and get across to people is by being yourself. And then some people don't like it, but that's fine. But I think that's the best way you can do it, is be the best version of you, because otherwise it's just fake, you know. Tell you who's actually Flea. He was boss. So they were just about, it must have been like 20 minutes before they went on, and we were like, there's Flea, and he was just jogging up and down with his mad like cat suit on, with his hoodie on over the top and that. And he was so sound, and you could just tell he was just himself, and they've toured for years and years, and he knows exactly what he's doing. But he was prepping, so he's talking to us, but he's like that, and he's just jogging on the spot. Boxing. He's talking about all the jazz he's into, but he's prepping, you know, he's getting in the mindset, but at the same time as being this sound fella who's having a laugh with you.
Yeah.
And then me and Russ, I think it was just me and Russ, went and watched him on stage. We were just blown away.
And he mentioned you guys, is that right?
Yeah, he said sort of that. Yeah,
I met these guys.
How crazy your hands. Yeah. But what a guy. Just like when you meet people like that, you think, oh, you know, you can just see like they're just being them, and it's boss. They're just comfortable in their own skin and not trying to be nothing else.
And you just showed me a photo of when Ringo came down to the studio, which is amazing. You had a Beatle come and he listened to some stuff that you've been recording.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how did that feel?
I was made up, because when he come in, we haven't put the sax on. I think it was Little Red Door. There isn't sax on that. What was it? Don't Get Caught or something. There's no sax on that either.
See if you want to look.
No, it was Little Red Door. No, I think it was, anyway, whatever it was. There was no sax, and he was like, where's the sax, man? There's no sax on this one. And I was like that. And then we got pictures outside, and he was like, I want to stand by the girl.
Oh, did he?
My name's Abby. So, no, it was dead sound. But I remember waiting, and all day George and Bruce was like, yeah, he might come down, he might not. We've asked them. And I was sitting out the front, just like in the sun, and he turned up in this like beat up old car. Like,
really?
This little white shitty car. Yeah, just pulled in. I remember thinking, I was like, yeah, it's probably not Ringo. And then he got out of the car, and I was like, fuck hell. And I like ran up to him, I was like, oh my god. Like, just, you know, you sound like an idiot, and you just go, you're speaking about this, hi man. But yeah, it was boss, and
why was he there? Like, what was it, just to kind of give you feedback? Was it
because we were just a Scouse band, I think. It was because he knew George, and George Reculius, the producer.
Okay.
And George, we'd been down to his gig the week before. He'd had this gig at the House of Blues on the Sunset Strip, and we'd went down. We hadn't met him after, because it was all chocolate, I think. And then George had said to him, oh, I'm producing the Zootons at Sunset. And he went, oh, I might come down next week, because he knew we were from Liverpool. And he did.
Oh, nice.
And he come down, and we were like, do you want a drink? And he was like, I'll take nothing unless you've got a green tea. So we got him a green tea, and then he only drank a bit, and we left it in the cupboard, and it went mouldy. No one was allowed to touch it. It was like the shrine to Ringo. Don't touch the cupboard. But he was dead sad. He sat off for a bit, and then it just got off. Yeah, he was lovely.
So that third album, I think Russ told me that you had to release the album a lot quicker than you intended to. Like, it had to be rush released before like an April, because for some reason Sony wanted to put it out earlier. Did it feel like a rushed release, or?
No, I don't know. I don't know. I was going to say, at the end of the time we were there maybe was some kind of rush, but I don't know. I actually don't know. I don't remember that.
And I mean, you released that album, you toured it, I think, and then, but you didn't really have a big kind of send off or final gig before you guys disbanded. Is that right? Is
yeah,
it, it kind of petered out, and you said, "Oh, we'll see, we'll get together in a few years."
Yeah, yeah.
And do you regret the way that that kind of finished?
No, because I think if you split up, because we didn't like, it was never like the Zootons have split up. It was just like, oh, we're doing something else. So there's always a, it's open, isn't it? You know what I mean? For something else to happen again. Not that it's not. If you obviously bands reform, but.
How did you feel at that time when you realised that the Zootons were kind of bookending that bit there? And what was your first emotion?
Like, obviously I was gutted to for it not to be going on anymore, but I don't think it was just wasn't really working the way it was anymore. So there was almost like maybe a bit of relief with a heavy heart kind of thing. But it wasn't until ages later when I was like, I really realised, and I was like, oh, that's not happening. Like, I don't, not that you think it's going to happen again, but it, I don't know, you've just been living this life for like 10 years, and then even though it stops, your head hasn't stopped or something. Like, I it didn't upset me until quite a long time later that we weren't doing it anymore.
Yeah.
And then I was like, really gutted. Like,
were you?
And like, what, you know, because I thought we were such a good band. I was like, why? What happened? Why? And you're thinking, why did it happen? Why, you know, why aren't we doing stuff anymore? But at the time, it was the right thing to do. So that's all you can really take. But yeah, it didn't. It like the sadness or whatever, or the yeah, it didn't really come till like probably a couple of years later. That when I was like, oh my god, we were so good. Or when till I had the guts to put one of the records on, and then was just like. Like, we did that this gig for our friend who died last year.
I was going to say, Chris Ealy, is that right?
Christine, yeah. And so I hadn't listened to our stuff for ages, and I was like, oh, shit, what did I play on that? And, like, you know, I'll just put
relearn all the parts.
And I couldn't stop crying. And I was like, why the fuck aren't we together? Like, this is fucking boss. What are we doing? But, you know, if everything happens, I think, for a reason, and you don't know what will happen in the future, so...
How was playing those? It was a one-off gig.
Yeah,
wasn't
it was nuts. It was nuts.
Did you rehearse much beforehand?
A week.
You did a week of rehearsals?
A week, but Sean lives in LA, so yeah. He had to come back for it. The relationships in the band are different from what they were.
Yeah.
Like, it was weird. It was dead weird. But for me personally, it was really odd. I think it was weird for everyone.
Yeah.
But it was so emotional. But it was. Christian was like one of our best friends. And so it was all that was around it. And, you know, we wanted it to be like a celebration for him, but you know, it was just a really sad time as well for all of us. He was like, you know, I loved Christian a lot, and Russ was we were all really good mates with him, so it was, you know, it was the boss thing that we could do because he's you know, he left his son behind and stuff like that, so it was nice for him to come and celebrate, you know, his dad's life or whatever, but that was the purpose for it, kind of thing. So it was, but just. But thinking about the gig, it was mad. Like, because it's just one, and you're like, we're not doing this again tomorrow. This is all we've got. So you're like, you want to get in your groove dead quick because you've only got like an hour to play. And it was amazing, but it just went so quick. And my heart was like over here, up here somewhere during most of it. I remembered, I loved it, but I don't really remember it. Like, I do and I don't. It was just like weird, like, but boss.
An amazing tribute. So what a great thing that you did there.
Yeah.
Cool. And so since then also you started playing with the Lightning Suits.
Yeah.
Played a bit of keyboards in them as well. Mm. So you keyboardist, pianist.
Well, that's how I write on the piano.
Right.
Like,
okay.
But I'm not a keyboardist. I can play chords and I can write a song.
Yeah.
So, but it's been good playing with Ian because I've probably learned quite a bit. Like, because I don't just play like the chords. I'll have to play like little riffs and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's probably taught me a few things without like actually realizing that.
And because you play some lovely, so Lion Sea, great band. actually, the third single I ever bought was Sugar Coated House.
Oh yeah,
third single I ever bought. And great band, amazing songwriting in Brody, but quite an understated character you kind of mentioned earlier. So how did it come about? Did you obviously had a relationship with Ian from working with him from years before? Did he just kind of pick up the phone and think, oh, saxophone will work well on particular?
Oh, we've been friends since. Yeah. Like, we've just kept in touch. And after the Zootons, me and Sean were doing some work together.
Yeah.
And he we went in with Ian and we recorded a track with Ian then. So he's always been in our lives, yeah. really, kind of thing, like on and off. But especially the last like 5 years, and he'd come and give us his advice when on the songs we were doing together and stuff like that. And so we were friends.
What's been the main challenges playing the Lightning Seeds that you hadn't experienced before playing with anyone else?
Having to sit down. I don't know.
But did you ever play keyboards in
that, playing the keyboards?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, sorry, playing the keyboards. I remember the first gig. Oh my God. Jimmy was playing the drums as well. So we practiced like a week, I think we'd had a week of rehearsals, and I've never played keyboard. I admit that in the Zootons, the record that the songs we were doing at the end that no one's heard, I'd started to play a couple of things, but literally little one note thing, like not hard things. So I was having to learn like all these tunes and like never playing keyboards. And like, you know, there's only so much information you can retain. So we're sitting, it's in Warrington, it is the first gig in this Golden Square, it's called, it's like by the shopping centre. And I remember looking at Jimmy at the start, the first tune, just going, I don't know what the chord is. And I'm going, I think it's a C, is it a C minor or a C major? And like, I remember playing, Ian was like, said to me, okay, don't worry, but the only thing you can't really fuck up is the intro of Life of Riley, because you're on your own. And I was like, yeah, yeah, it's fine. I remember playing it the first time, and I was like, it sounds a bit weird. And I realised I was playing it all in a minor key, and it's me. And he just turned around and went, and I'm like, what's going on? So that was a challenge, the keyboard. Shit. But now, like, after I've done it, like, last summer, this summer, and we supported Madness last December.
Yeah, was that at O2?
We played at the O2, yeah.
Was that Madness you were supporting?
Yeah. So after now doing it for a while, it's I'm a lot more confident on it. But at the beginning, I wasn't.
You're doing a good job on it. And I tell you what, the job you do on with the saxophone on Pure is just...
Oh, yeah.
It suits it so well. It's like, it's beautiful. Yeah. And it looks like you're having a great time at those shows. And, yeah. Like, you do Three Lions, which...
We've done it, like, once.
Was that... was at the O2, I think.
A couple of times, yeah. Ian doesn't like doing it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm reluctant to do it, I imagine, but like, that's a song that means a lot to a lot of people. But I was like, even watching a recording just on YouTube of you guys playing it recently, and just like this like nostalgia dagger just hits me.
Oh, really?
yeah, massively. I really do genuinely think that, like, for people who are listening in other countries, it's a song that was written for the England football team in 1996, and it was a great time in England at the time, and we sadly lost in the semi-finals, and that was kind of the song that kind of went alongside it, and so there's a lot of nostalgia in there. So he's quite an understated character, and sometimes seen as kind of, I guess in some ways that makes him a little bit underrated because he's going under the radar so often, but he's a real craftsman, isn't he, Ian, when it comes to his songwriting? He's a really good songwriter.
Yeah, he's great, he's brilliant, and he's writing new songs at the minute.
Is he?
Really good, yeah. He is, yeah, he really delves in, you know, like, right when he's worked with, like, other stuff that I've done with him before, you think you can, like, kid yourself, you're like, yeah, the bridge is all right, you know, you, like, kind of, like, get to the chorus quick kind of thing, and he's like, hey, let's just go back on, you know what I mean, he'll pick it, yeah, which is right, because at the end of the day, you want the best thing, don't you, but he is, he's a great musician, he's a great songwriter, and he's just a great fella, he's really good to work with, and... Like what I was saying before about the way he makes you feel at ease, and you know, you don't. I'm because he's my friend as well, you know, I'm just really comfortable around him, and I enjoy being in his company. He's boss.
So, a lot of the stuff you've done in your career, some of these highlights we're talking about, are things that a lot of young musicians would aspire to experience. How does that experience actually play out in comparison to what you thought it would be like growing up as kids? So when you wanted to be a musician and that kind of thing, is it the same? Is it everything you wanted it to be? Or is, like, there's touring pressures you don't see, so you're just like, oh, it's not quite what I thought it was going to be? How does that compare the reality to what you thought it might be?
I never thought I'd be doing this when I was a kid. So I never thought about it.
Yeah.
I love touring. I never thought I'd be in a band when I was a kid. I never thought I'd be playing saxophone. I did think I'd be singing. Like, that is something I did think I'd do. And it filled every expectation. But I think that's just more the feeling of actually when you're doing it is, like, get the biggest thrill out of. Like, I love it. Like, there's nothing... You can just forget anything else that's going on in your head, in your mind. singing and playing something makes me feel great, and I don't have to think about anything else. Any like problems or worries you've got, they're not in your head when you're playing, because unless it's like you're singing about one of your problems. Yeah. But that's great because you can just express it and you can like go feel that emotion. And you know, unless you've got to, you know, sometimes you might have to sing it every night if you're on tour. So, and I haven't experienced that yet because I haven't gone on tour as my own band. But I think then it just evolves, and you probably, it's like a therapy. It's like a boss form of therapy, because you just get to express it, feel it, and hopefully get through it. If it's something that is a problem in life that you're singing about. But if it's like, you know, when the Zootons, everything else just forgetting. When you're on stage and you're playing, or in your studio, or you just, that's what you're doing, that's all you're thinking about, or you're not thinking about it, you're just doing it.
Yeah.
And it's best, and they're the only times I think in my life when you're really in the moment, because you're not distracted, you're just doing it, and that's all you're doing, but you're not thinking about it, you're just doing it. Do you know what I mean?
Eric Clapton referred that to being in harmony with time.
That's what I'm talking about.
Cool. So we'll begin to wrap up. Just a couple of last questions. So, advice for young musicians. What would you say if some young musician said,
"Oh God, play with other people." That was my best advice. Just go, and if you want to get better, play with other people. Just don't be open minded to anything. Like, if you think you want something doing a certain way, or you want something to sound and someone else thinks it a different way, try both.
Yeah.
And then if you still think you're always best sound, do that. But try anything, play with other people. Just like, just don't stop learning. Don't think you know it all, because you're never going to. Like,
constantly broaden your horizons.
Constantly, yeah. Like, I've learned more in the last couple of years off doing my own band than ever. Like, And I can see how much more there is to learn. Like, but just it doesn't stop.
Doesn't stop. And on that point that you've learned stuff in the last couple of years, what advice would you give yourself when you were joining the Zootons now?
Don't worry about it. Stop worrying. Like, don't worry and so much. And just, like, I don't know, chill out a bit. Like, loose. Like, I think I used to be quite nervous, like, a lot more than I am now, and yeah, just chill out and don't worry about it.
What fears do you have for the music industry, and how might those fears be addressed?
I don't know, the fears are almost that, like, the fears that maybe I have are also great things. Like, so anyone can do anything now. Anyone who's got a program of whatever logic software on their computer can do anything. So, like what you said before, you know, you have to be careful with some of the loops, because you thought you had your tune, you know what I mean? Yeah. So that kind of thing. But that's...
So the context of that is, I was saying, I did some Apple loops, used some Apple loops on Logic, and which are copyright free and you're allowed to use, and you're encouraged to use them for drum beats and stuff like that. And then I was watching like an advert and thought my own song was on the TV, but of course it wasn't. It was these Apple loops being used quite a lot before.
Yeah. So. Fears for the music industry, like... Well, I think it would be good if, like, I remember someone saying this ages ago, and I agree. Like, I don't like categorizing anything, but like the way things, like, now a lot of people are into, like, you know, X Factor and stuff like that, and like that kind of show and that kind of music, I think that should be like a different thing. To like, they should have their own charts, they should have their own like thing, and it should be a different thing. It should be like a karaoke cabaret thing. I know you do get some good people out of that, and like some people have great voices, but it's not the same as like going writing your own tunes and doing it that way. It's a different thing. I just think it's different, but the fact that everyone's in together, it seems a bit odd. And I don't, maybe that's going to have its day soon, I don't know. It doesn't seem to have kind of lost any steam though, does it?
But do you know why? I think it's because younger generations are coming up who've never seen it. So people have watched the X Factor for years, are sick to the back teeth.
Yeah.
But it's like,
but there's still 15, people common.
16 year olds. You know, that kind of.
Yeah. I don't know what fears I have for the music industry though.
But no, I think it's fair, like, it's a fair point that people who are writing their own stuff and performing their own stuff aren't getting quite the exposure they might do because they've got to compete with just another cover of whatever fucking big.
Someone's gone too
Olympic
forces.
Ballad.
Exactly. So to me, I get like a little bit like overwhelmed with the options there is now, like, because like when the Zootons were around, this was just beginning, but no one really, like, I've just got Logic a few weeks ago, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm kind of a bit late to it, but when we were starting, the record companies were still massive then, like there was still more money in it, in that way of doing things. Now there's a million ways you can do it. And for me, I get overwhelmed by the amount of options you've got because there's just so many avenues to pick. Yeah. And it's like, which is the right one and which... And that's maybe my worrying head coming on. I should just, you know, do... If you find something that's comfortable for you, then go that way and just, you know, don't stop until it becomes uncomfortable and then change, whatever. But... That's all you know, I can say really is I get overwhelmed with the amount of options, but that is a really good thing. And that's like so great for like kids who are really good on technology, which I'm not, which I'm learning, trying to learn to be better. But because I kind of missed that, I'm like the generation before Facebook kind of thing. But you know, the kids who are all up on all that stuff now can so easily get into it, and it's so easy for them to do. You can get any small program, GarageBand. I don't know if that's still a thing.
So
that's like that comes with your Mac. You know, you can just get that for nothing, and you can create music with a computer. Like it's amazing. It's this, but for me, someone who's not totally grown up with it can be quite overwhelming. But I'm trying to grasp it, and I'm trying to just. See it as a positive, because it is.
Thanks for such an honest answer. And I'm going to finish the interview on a quote from you from a few years ago.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So this is a few years ago. You said about singing, you said, I used to do it in pubs and always did well at it. My speciality was Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly with his song. I don't rate myself that highly as a singer, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility of fronting my own band someday.
When did I say that?
A few years ago.
Oh, fuck.
So glad that you did go down that route. Well done. And thank you, Abby, for your insight. Good luck with the writing. The stuff you just played, you sounded great. And good luck with future shows. We look forward to hearing the rest of your recordings coming out in due course. And thanks for appearing on the Stage Left podcast. It's been fun.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris. It's been lovely. I hear whispers. I hear someone say. I hear talking. Don't go that way. I hear whispers, but I turn my face. I'm beside you in my right place. And where would I be if I didn't see you coming?
So that was Abby Harding. Thank you so much to Abby and all the guys in Liverpool over the last month or so. It's been great, and what a interesting and insightful kind of hour that was. Love the honesty. Love the way that Abby really, really broke down some of the kind of components of some of the songs that she's kind of been writing recently and that kind of thing. It's been really, really great to be able to hear that. So make sure you go and support her. So go to her Instagram page and her Facebook and Twitter, and make sure you follow her and that kind of stuff, because there's some good music that's going to be coming out from her in the near future. For further episodes, go to thestageleftpodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @thestageleftpod and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/stageleftpodcast. And what you can also do is just press subscribe. So if you're listening at the moment on, say, iTunes or on Spotify or on a podcast app, for instance, if you click subscribe, each episode just is kind of automatically downloaded for when you want to listen to it. So as it's released, you just get one notification saying it's been released, and you can
can listen to it in your own time. So yeah, please subscribe. That really helps us. And if you want to leave reviews, you can do that. That really helps us too. Further episodes are available on there with the likes of Tony Visconti, Steve Cropper from Booker T and the MGs, Russ from the Zootons and Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, Kieran Pepper of the Prodigy, Billy Burnett from Fleetwood Mac, Elvis Presley's pianist, Shane Keister telling some interesting stories about playing with Elvis, and loads more. So there's 39 episodes now, I think, so make sure you get to get along and have a listen to them when you can. Okay, so we'll be back next month for an episode with Wolfgang Flöhr of Kraftwerk. See you then.